Morning.
Committee on Civil Law is now in session. I apologize for the delay, but we're waiting for some of our members to get here. We do not have a quorum to work into a work session. However, we can call Chair Krieger at the appropriate time and accommodate that. I assume that Reverend Gerard will be here shortly, and that will supply our quorum if we need it. So what we're going to do is at least do public hearings and keep the opportunities open for work session as a quorum develops. So with that, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2247. Council?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2247 has dash one amendments, relatively lengthy. They replace the measure. These amendments modify regulations with respect to manufactured dwelling parks, floating homes, mortgages, mobile home parks, and recreational vehicle parks. The witnesses for this bill will further explain the details of this.
Thank you. I have three proponents and no one in opposition, so the three proponents want to come forward right now. Thank you.
Something about floating homes.
Oh, okay.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So you get applause. So this is and my applause is, I think it's justified because I think you're telling me that you've brought to us a package which has been put together and be non-controversial for us. So the applause is deserved. Let's see how well you do. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We don't have anything else to add. No.
Great. You're in.
My name is John Van Landingham. I'm a lawyer with Lane County Law and Advocacy Center in Eugene. I'm a constituent of Representative Ackerman. I'm here with Pat Schwach, who is a representative of the Manufactured Housing Residents Organization, and Chuck Carpenter, who's a representative of the Manufactured Housing Park Landlords Organization. We're all three here testifying in favor of 2247-1. I was actually here about 3 months ago testifying against 2247 in the form it was in then, but we do support the dash one amendments to 2247. Oregon's residential landlord tenant law was adopted in 1973. In 75, the legislature added manufactured housing tenancies, where the tenant or resident owns her home and rents a space in a park for that home. Because those tenants have a significant investment in their homes, and it's difficult to move them, they have protections that other tenants do not have. There are special statutes in the Landlord-Tenant Act to protect them. Amendments to the landlord-tenant law have historically been negotiated by coalitions of tenants and landlords, and that's the case here. And amendments have only been adopted since the early 80s if that coalition produced a bill to do that. There are two coalitions now, this coalition on manufactured housing tenancies and the general landlord-tenant coalition. That coalition's bill came before you about a month ago, 2 months ago, HB 2524, and you endorsed it. This 2247-1 is the Manufactured Housing Coalition's bill. It's identical to SB 636. I spent yesterday making sure. I can go through the detail if you would like. I've given you a very lengthy 15-page analysis of the details of the bill. The coalitions typically like to have that to help them explain it to their members and for future use. Or not. I will defer to the chair to tell me whether to give any detail, and I've also asked Pat and Chuck to comment.
My advice in this situation is, counsel, it's yours to lose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have anything to add. I should have stopped after the first
one. Next witness.
Yes, Chair Ackerman, for the record, my name is Pat Schwach. I'm Executive Director of Manufactured Homeowners. This is a bill that we spent a whole year working on. Nobody came out with bruises. Everybody came to a happy agreement, and we want to see this bill go forward. It's something that's extremely important to the residents. we've asked for a long time to have manager training, and among us, we've all agreed on it. I'll answer any questions if there are some, and I'll defer to Chuck Carpenter.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Chuck Carpenter, Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. As mentioned earlier, representing the landlords, property owners in this case. We spent a good long time over the last year working through John Van Lanningham's expertise to negotiate out this piece of legislation. And in years past, it always seems we have several issues that are beneficial to landlords and then several issues that are beneficial to residents. I think the main three issues here are beneficial to both parties, and we're very happy with the outcome, and I think it'll be good not only for landlords and residents but for the industry as a whole.
Yeah. Fine, thank you very, very much. I didn't mean to belittle your work product by any means, but I do praise you for bringing in a compromise solution to something that's always very contentious in the area of landlord-tenant law. You really are heroes in bringing this forward with the least amount of involvement from us. So, anyway, is there any questions from the committee to the panel on the bill? Hearing none, you must have done your job really well. Thank you very, very much. And what I'll do is conclude the public hearing at this time, unless anyone else is in the audience who would like to testify. Seeing none, the public hearing is concluded, and I'll hold the work session open on that until a quorum materializes or until I have to go get somebody for that purpose.
Well, we can't work it anyway.
Oh, that's right.
So
okay.
We just got 3 days.
Okay, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2693. Council?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2693 with the dash 2 amendments provide that employers are not required to accommodate the use of medical marijuana regardless of whether it's used in the workplace or not. It provides that employers are not required to either allow an employee, an independent contractor, or an independent contractor possess, consume, or be impaired by the use of marijuana during working hours, or allow any person who is impaired by the use of marijuana to remain on a workplace. And it provides that nothing in the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act will preclude an employer from establishing or enforcing a policy to achieve or maintain a drug-free workforce. As mentioned previously, this bill is in response to a recent Court of Appeals case, Washburn versus Columbia Forest Products. And it would basically allow an employer to treat an employee with a medical marijuana card in a similar fashion that employer would treat other employees.
Thank you. I have 5 witnesses, 2 for, 2 against, and 1 neutral. So I think I'll have the neutral person come forward first and get a balanced approach to this issue. Mr. Rutledge?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dale Rutledge, and I am a retired Oregon State Police Lieutenant, retired in January of this year after almost 28 years of service. My job immediately prior to retiring, I was the Northwest Region Lieutenant for administrative matters in patrol function, which includes impaired driving. I was also the state coordinator for the Drug Evaluation Classification Program. That program is part of a national program sponsored by the International Association of Chiefs of Police, as well as the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. I became a certified drug recognition expert in 1996 and became an instructor for that program in 1997, and since that time have taught at each of the schools in Oregon, as well as teaching in Washington and in Alaska on several occasions. What I want to talk to you about today is really the concern that I have about the impairment of the marijuana causes. And if you read the literature, as DREs, we're taught that a high, when somebody smokes marijuana, that high can last for about 2 to 3 hours. What In addition to that, we find is that impairment can last much longer than that. There's a number of studies out there involving airline pilots and flying a simulator. And what they can demonstrate by using these complex tasks is that the impairment can last up to 24 hours without the person being aware that they're impaired. And this was a study that was done, I believe, back in the 80s, maybe early 90s. And that is cited in a number of the literature or texts that we have. Now, I want to put somebody that's using it in kind of a euphoric state with a heightened sense of awareness, but it can impair the person's perception of time and distance. Chronic users have detriments in motivation, cognition, judgment, and perception. Dr. Robert Julian is a retired anesthesiologist from St. Vincent's Hospital in Portland, and he authored a book. It's called The Primer of Drug Action, and in that they talk about the long-term use, comparing chronic users of about 20 years to young users and the differences between those. And he was able to demonstrate, or at least in the study that he cites in this book, they were able to demonstrate that there is a difference between a person's ability, chronic use versus short-term use. I think that's really important to remember, as in all drugs, alcohol being one of the primary ones I think everybody's aware of. The body can build up a tolerant effect to that. What that means is that it takes more and more of the alcohol to get the person to the same point in terms of their high. And the same is true of heroin. When somebody uses heroin, they're always chasing that initial high that they got because the effects reduce over time unless they use more and more of that. One last thing I'd like to say is that when we test somebody for marijuana, you know, usually you say a one-time user or a casual user of marijuana test positive in their urine sample 24 to 36 hours after the ingestion. However, if they're a chronic user, they can abstain for up to 30 days and still test positive. And that's because the THC builds up in the body. And a study using monkeys, one thing that they discovered was the tetrahydrocannabinol, the active ingredient in marijuana, deposits itself in the brain in the neurons. And as a result of that, it thickens the wall of the neurons, causing a slowing, which, you know, can be demonstrated by the fact that people who are chronic users of cannabis have difficulty with cognition and remembering things and that type of thing. So there's a lot of information out there about the long-term effects of cannabis, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that background material. That is helpful to us. Is there other questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rutledge, in your experience over the years in this particular field, can you comment on the current potency of THC as compared to today, as compared to what it may have been 10 or 20 years ago?
Sure. With hydroponics and some of the indoor grow operations with halide lights and different things, we're finding that the increased potency of marijuana is it's going up. And Oregon is noted for having some of the best marijuana in terms of, you know, if you're a user of it in the country, the most potent. That is to say that concentration of THC in the buds is much higher. Now, for example, when I first started 28 years ago in law enforcement, people were smoking the leaves of the marijuana. Today, they don't even look at the leaves of the marijuana. The only thing they're focused on is the buds. And it's the difference between drinking, say, maybe a beer or drinking Everclear alcohol. It's been described to me that way by some of the people. When we do certification training down in Portland, we go down and we round up these people, basically, ask for their cooperation to do evaluations. And some of these people who admit to using marijuana will tell us that some of this stuff is so strong that they really don't like to use it because it gives them such a shock. The chronic users love it because of that tolerant effect. it now gives them more of what they're looking for. But for the casual user, that the potency has gotten to the point where it's like drinking Everclear alcohol. It's really not for the enjoyment of it as opposed to, say, a beer. So.
Thank you. Further questions? Yes, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rutledge, I'm referring to the book that you referred to from Dr. Robert Julian in that, on a primer of drug action. Now, I've kind of done a little bit of research into that book myself as well, and I also know that there's a portion of it that mentions that depending on the THC level, unless someone does not smoke a great deal, the effects seldom last longer than 3 to 4 hours. But then also, I've just heard you testify to the point where you said impairment can last up to 24 hours.
Yes.
So I guess if you could maybe tie all that together for me, give a little bit better picture for the THC level versus that of the impairment, the tie in there.
Well, really the difference, the impairment, the person's high, similar to being drunk or impaired. The person is aware that they're impaired. And you know, typically they'll go down and find these people or even stop them on the road. And they'll be giddy and laughing kind of nonchalant about the whole thing. But after that marijuana wears off, their high dissipates, but they're still impaired. That is that their cognition is still infected. They're not able to think as quickly. Their reactions are not as as quick. Some of the driving studies that they've done in the Netherlands indicate, you know, they have distance and time perception problems. So it's hard to say without further demonstration or studies that to really say what the effect is. However, the airline pilot study, that complex task of landing a plane on the center of the runway, you have to judge time and distance and everything. These pilots, after 24 hours, who are trained to fly these planes, were having difficulty with that task, which I think is a demonstration of the continued effect, even though they were unaware of it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Are there further questions from the committee? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'm going to call up the two proponents, Tim Sylvester and Rick Howell. I guess I have another one, Lisa Trussell. Please come forward. Good morning.
Good morning.
You may proceed any manner you wish.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak today about the proposed changes to the Medical Marijuana Act.
Could you give us your name, please, for the record? I'm sorry.
Rick Howell.
Okay, thank you.
In spite of the federal court's supreme ruling last week, I encourage you to take action on the Oregon law. The federal ruling does not answer all the questions that we have here. My name is Rick Howell, and I have been in Human Resources for 19 years. I'm familiar with this act's influence in the workplace because of circumstances at my company. In addition, as the past president of the Portland Human Resource Management Association, with almost 1,100 members, I have spoken to a few hundred HR professionals who share my concerns. While the initiative process expresses the will of the people, it can create laws with unexpected consequences. As I understood the publicity to pass this ballot measure, the intent was to provide for improved quality of life in the last days of those who are gravely ill, to comfort those undergoing cancer treatment, to stimulate an appetite for AIDS patients, and to treat others who have no alternatives for their terminal condition. This law was meant for those too sick to work. Today, with approximately 10,000 medical marijuana cards issued, we have employees with nothing more than a sore back being issued cards, routinely using the drug, and then coming into work, even if there are alternatives to their pain management. Marijuana is not a prescription drug. It is not given in measured doses on a regular timetable. The medical marijuana card is an authorization to self-medicate. The potency from plant to plant can vary dramatically, and unlike manufactured medicine that has been rigorously tested, marijuana and its accumulative effect is not well known. Employers are put in an awkward position and should not bear the burden of trying to calculate when an employee is impaired. We have an obligation, morally and by law, to maintain a safe workplace. If the Medical Marijuana Act allows an employee with a card to enter the workplace and perform his or her duties like any sober person, in safety-sensitive occupations, this could have a disastrous consequence. I don't want to entrust my health and safety to those providing my public transportation, my medical treatment, or those operating dangerous equipment next to me using marijuana, and neither does anyone else I know. We protect our employees by prohibiting them from being under the influence of illegal drugs, alcohol, and even certain prescription and over-the-counter medications. But now, the way the law is written, we can't protect our employees from those using this mind-altering and reaction-slowing drug just because they have a medical marijuana card. We're in a double jeopardy situation. We will certainly be held liable if someone is injured on the job, even if it's the user himself, while we are also being sued by those employees with a medical marijuana card who are saying they have a right to use this drug routinely and continue to work. Unlike alcohol or prescription drugs, there is no predetermined level at which an employer can say this person is under the influence. What are we supposed to do? How are we supposed to keep our workplaces safe? If there's an accident in an Oregon job site as a result of a cardholder using marijuana, we'll have tens of thousands asking to alter this law and questioning why it was ever allowed in the workplace. We all know that there will be an accident, so why wait? Please alter the wording of this act to prohibit marijuana in the workplace. It's not safe. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Okay, who's next?
I think I'll go next. Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Tim Sylvester from the Department of Justice, Criminal Justice Division. I'm appearing specifically in support of the Dash 2 amendments you have before you that clarify the scope of the clause in the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act that provides that nothing in the act shall be construed to require certain activities on the part of an employer. The purpose of this particular amendment is to clarify the law in response to the recent decision by the Oregon Court of Appeals in the Washburn case that was mentioned earlier. I guess I'm largely responsible for the draft that is before the committee. I was trying to draft what essentially would be a compromise to protect the legitimate interests of the employers in this situation in light of Washburn. And what it does is you need to read this particular thing kind of in the negative, because what this is an exemption from the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, and what it says is the act shall not require certain things of the employer. And for one thing, it does not require, you want to make clear that it does not require the employer to allow any employee or independent contractor, regardless of where this person may be, whether or not on a job site, but while that person is on the clock, to engage in the medical use of marijuana or to be impaired by the use of marijuana. Also, it does not, it allows an employer to not allow someone who is impaired by the use of marijuana to remain in any workplace and not to accommodate the use of marijuana on the workplace. And so it is designed to preclude either an employee, an independent contractor, or anybody else from coming onto workplaces in circumstances in which they are impaired or while possessing marijuana or while using marijuana. But on the other hand, not necessarily preclude an employer from terminating somebody simply because they may have metabolites in their blood from use in the past. Unless members of the committee have questions, that's all I have.
Fine, we'll take questions of the panel when everyone's testified.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Tressel with AOI, and I was here last week for the hearing. I wanted to make you aware of Paula Barron's written testimony, which I submitted because she was unable to attend today. And also just when we were here last week, the U.S. Supreme Court decision had just become issued, and it's still our belief that even in light of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision, we still need the amendments to House Bill 2693, because without them, the court case, which is on the books, will remain on the books, and Mr. Howell happens to be with Columbia Forest Products, which I noticed that he didn't mention, but that was their case. And so then the only way to get rid of it is it just doesn't seem to make sense to us that that we'd have to continue litigating. They'd have to appeal their case up to the Oregon Supreme Court, or we'd have to have other employers litigate theirs when you could easily fix it by the amendments to House Bill 2693.
Fine, thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Counsel.
Mr. Sylvester, I may have not heard you correct. I want to point back to your last statement. You indicated that the bill doesn't go as far as to allow employers to... How would this bill, in your opinion, allow employers to deal with employees who are found taking positive tests for marijuana?
Well, that would not necessarily, and maybe the other members up here would disagree with me, but that would not necessarily fall within any of the exemptions that are set forth there. Certainly, if the person is possessing marijuana on the work site or during working hours, the employer would not need to accommodate or allow that. Also, the employer would not need to accommodate or allow someone coming to work who is impaired from the prior use of marijuana during off hours. The way this is written, I don't think it necessarily enables an employer to terminate someone who is not impaired, but otherwise may be for legitimate medical reasons using marijuana off the clock, off the work area, and coming to work in a state in which he is not actually impaired.
I have a general question. Could you tell me how this plays out in the workplace? In other words, do you have random testing that would provide this information, or do you see someone that's, at risk for something and you feel you should make an inquiry? Tell me what the threshold is for bringing this up at the workplace.
Different employers do different things. Most employers will do testing for cause. If they've got any kind of testing program at all, it's usually pre-employment. They'll test for cause. If your employee falls under the Federal Department of Transportation, then there's a random drug testing there, and then other employers will institute a random drug testing for all employees. It really depends from employer to employer how it's implemented.
Okay. Does the same standard apply to an employee or a prospective employee that may be under the effects of a prescription drug?
Yes.
They be treated similarly to persons that have symptoms of marijuana in their system?
Yeah, prescription drugs, alcohol, illegal drugs.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Representative Flores.
Well, peripheral vision you have. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sylvester, in your second point of this bill was, or the amendments were designed for two purposes, the second of which Council Sears mentioned, preclude employees with possible residue, not to preclude employees with possible residue. In other words, and you clarified to say that they would not be impaired. However, Mr. Rutledge indicated that impairment level can last up to 24 hours. So is there a conflict there?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Flores, members of the committee. Well, the question is whether or not the way this is written is, it says, allow an employer is not required by the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act to allow any person who is impaired by the use of marijuana to remain in any workplace. And there may be dispute about whether someone legitimately is impaired or not, and it may depend upon what functions the employee is serving on the job site. If the employee is driving a bus or a locomotive or operating heavy machinery, and the person is an illegitimate cardholder under the Act and has a disability and is using medical marijuana legitimately for that purpose off hours and at home and comes to work, but as a result of that, hours later, the employer legitimately thinks that that person is sufficiently impaired by the use of that, and that can somehow be measured for performing his usual job functions, I think that this would give the employer coverage to say, I don't want you doing that. I don't want you coming on to work in a circumstance in which you are impaired by our legitimate job requirements. But it would require some degree of showing of impairment, and the previous witness testified that impairment may last in some respects over a period of time, and I guess that will just need to be resolved on a case-by-case basis.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, and maybe Rick could address this better, but it's my understanding that in the employment arena testing, they're not testing for impairment. And I'm not aware of what acceptable tests there are to determine impairment on medical marijuana. Most of them, it's just a test to see what level is detected. And different companies have different thresholds, although I think that some have relatively similar threshold levels. But I'm not aware of what the impairment test an employer could use to determine whether it was safe for this individual or not. We're here in support of the Dash 1s, although the Dash 2s appear to be better than current. They address impairment, which we can't address.
I'll say that until better standards are defined for what is impairment, it's very difficult for the employer to determine, like alcohol, where a level of impairment is. We usually, well, all employers who do drug testing use independent laboratories. We rely on the independent laboratories to establish the threshold of the narcotic in the system. With alcohol, they usually use the state or federal law. With other drugs, they'll use what the Controlled Substance Act requires. So we don't determine that level. We spot impairment on the job. You know, it usually shows up in performance. My concern is that in a safety-sensitive job, we can't afford to wait for that to display itself. You know, if it was an accountant, I'm still not exactly happy about someone not being able to do their job to their fullest functions, but at least there the coaching and counseling process could kick in. In a safety-sensitive area, I cannot afford to let that first mistake go. It could be injurious to their coworker themselves or kill somebody.
May I follow up with a comment? And that is that I think a political decision needs to be made whether you want to have an exemption say that employer can discipline, effectively can discipline and terminate any employee who simply has a test result that shows metabolites, continuing metabolites in the blood during working hours, regardless of whether that person shows any degree of impairment, or whether you want to have a rule that allows for discipline and termination only if there is some degree of impairment on the job. I would point out that if you go the route of saying that an employer may terminate or discipline an employee simply for having metabolites in the blood as shown by a drug test, that may effectively preclude anybody who is a medical marijuana user from working in such a job, because my understanding is that these metabolites will persist for days or weeks. And so if you have someone who has a legitimate medical condition that and they are legitimately using medical marijuana for that purpose on a regular or daily basis, they may have metabolites in their blood all the time as a result of that. And if employers are allowed to terminate or discipline someone simply for failing a test by showing those metabolites, that person effectively will not be employable. And so there is, but that is the political decision that has to be made, and that is, do we put the standard at simply some degree of impairment, or do you want to put the standard at any evidence of drug use in the bloodstream?
Just a follow-up on that, is that choice made in the Dash 2 amendments?
Representative Ackerman, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, I think that's the way I drafted this one, is to be directed at impairment and not necessarily failing a blood test. If the voice of the committee, if the sentiment of the committee is to go to the direction of saying anybody who fails a blood test or a urine test by showing metabolites, then I think this should be clarified to specifically allow that exemption.
Thank you. Further questions of the committee? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to follow up on that, Mr. Sylvester. I think I understand what you're saying about the difference between the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s. That is, that if I'm hearing it right, under the Dash 1s, the employers would be able to establish a drug-free workplace, and any evidence, whether it was impairment or not, would be something that they could establish a policy to preclude that under the dash twos. I think I'm hearing you say that the intent is that they would have to show some level of, or identify some level of impairment in order to be able to apply that policy. Am I following that right?
I think that's correct, Representative McPherson, although dash two is a little bit more, it also talks about medical use of marijuana on the premises during working hours by employees or independent contractors or by anybody else. And so to that extent, the dash two are a bit more broad because it covers a lot more people, a lot more circumstances, and as a broader with respect to the actual use, possession, and impairment of marijuana. But I think that and maybe they will disagree with me on this, the way I drafted this was as far as an employer vis-a-vis an employee who was a legitimate user of medical marijuana, if the person is using solely off the job, outside of working hours, and comes on and is not at all, in fact, impaired by it, yes, that this would not cover that situation.
Follow up with Mike.
Yes, you may.
I read both of these amendments as creating and avoiding an obligation on the part of the employer to accommodate. There's nothing in any of these amendments that would prevent the employer from deciding to accommodate a medical marijuana user, who, say somebody who has a terminal illness and or serious illness and needs relief, from approaching their employer and developing an understanding with the employer that they're going to, in off hours, be using medical marijuana in order to relieve symptoms. Am I right about that?
Representative McPherson, that is correct. This is written as kind of a negative and saying the employer is not required to do this. Certainly, in an employer, in an individual case, depending upon the circumstances, can accommodate someone who is using medical marijuana however he or she may want. But this is simply saying that the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act shall not be construed to require an employer to allow an employee to come to work impaired by the use of marijuana, for example.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Fine. Thank you. Further questions from the committee? I guess we, counsel.
Mr. Sylvester, I have one more question for you. I'm looking at the dash two amendments, and I just for to clarify the scope of these amendments, and then if the committee wants to make changes, maybe we can do that in a further amendment. But I'm looking at lines 10 through 12, mm-hmm. And I just want to. It's my understanding that the scope of this would allow an employer to, I guess, deal with an employee that has metabolites in his or her system in a similar way to, and it has a medical marijuana card, to deal with that employee similarly to an employee who does not have a medical marijuana card. And I get that, taking out that term in the workplace, which the Washburn Court seemed to focus on, that the medical marijuana use had to happen at the workplace. It's changed to accommodating the use of medical marijuana regardless of where it occurs. So it's your opinion the effect of that does not allow that employer to I guess, fire that person if that employee has metabolites in his or her system?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Mr. Sears. Perhaps we are talking past each other on this one. The new subsection 2A talks about accommodation and doesn't specifically require the employer to do anything specific. And the way and medical use of marijuana has a definition under the Act that includes delivery, use, manufacture of marijuana. And so what this is saying is that the employer does not need to accommodate the cardholder's delivery, possession, or manufacture of marijuana at some other location. But I guess I was construing the word accommodate to mean that the employer, in its normal sense, employer does not need to facilitate that, does not need to allow the person to engage in that, and those sorts of things, but doesn't specifically deal with the situation of the person on his own time, on his own dollar at a different location is using that without the accommodation, without the facilitation, without the complicity of the employer, and he's just doing that as a legitimate medical exercise treatment, and then he comes to work not impaired. Does the employer necessarily accommodate that medical use of marijuana by allowing the person to come to work? And I guess the way I was construing that, maybe we were disagreeing. I don't think the employer is accommodating that by allowing the person to come to work. He is not accommodating the extracurricular use of medical marijuana simply because the person is coming to work in a non-impaired situation. I guess to answer the question, maybe the committee needs to make the political decision whether you want to allow employers to have the authority to discipline or terminate people who simply have, who come to work not impaired, who aren't using them on the job, and but do come to work with metabolites still in their system. Do you want to allow employers to discipline those persons? And if the answer is yes, then I think perhaps this language needs to be clarified specifically to allow that. At least in the current draft, I'm not sure that that's what the words say. Thank you.
Fine, thank you. Further questions from the committee? Okay, seeing none, you're excused. Thank you very much. I have two more witnesses, Michael Glaze and Clifford Spencer. If you'd like to come forward, please. You may proceed.
Pardon?
Go ahead. You may proceed. Okay, state your name for the record.
Michael Glaze.
If you come a little closer to the microphone, Mr. Glaze, you're kind of...
My name is Michael L. Glaze, resident of Oregon. Chair Ackerman. Pardon?
No, I'm just...
Chair Ackerman and representative of the committee. Stormy Ray could not be here today. She's very ill, so I'm going to read her one-page statement. And so I'm going to read it pretty fast. So slow me down if you want to. My name is Stormy Ray, and I'm one of the chief petitioners for Measure 67 that became Oregon's Medical Marijuana Act. I have served on the State Rehabilitation Advisory Council for two governors. I served on the Federal Disabilities Determination Board for 6.5 years. As president of Malheur Butte Productions, a nonprofit disabilities awareness organization, I worked hard to help improve access, inclusion, and awareness for Oregons with disabilities. I am currently president of the Stormy Ray Cardholders Foundation, a nonprofit organization. In all of my work, I have always advocated for improving access to employment for the disabled and preventing workplace discrimination. When the Stormy Ray Cardholders Foundation first asked Representative Steve Marsh to introduce HB 2693, it was intended to be a safety net that would protect OMA patients in case SB 772 did not pass. As it turned out, SB 772 is gaining support of both OMA patients and law enforcement, so Representative Marsh felt it would be better for us to concentrate on the Senate bill. I was alarmed when I learned that someone had taken our bill that was intended to improve OMA and proposed changing it to a bill that would allow workplace discrimination against disabled Oregonians. We were just asking that you treat us like anyone else who is disabled and has to take medicine. In fact, the first line of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act passed by voters in 1998 states that, findings, the people of the state of Oregon hereby find that patients and doctors have found marijuana to be an effective treatment for suffering caused by debilitating medical conditions, and therefore marijuana should be treated like other medicines. Allowing a person to be fired simply because they are using a legally recommended medication would not be treating marijuana like other medicines. There are no legally prescribed medicines treated in this manner. One of the most exciting aspects of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program is that many OMMP registrants have been able to continue working even with their affliction because of the relief medical marijuana provides. Patients that thought they would never work again. HB 2693 in its current form would put thousands of honest, taxpaying, productive citizens out of work. How many of these hardworking, taxpaying citizens are going to end up drawing unemployment or disability income because they are unable to keep a job? I am strongly opposed to this legislation that would allow employment discrimination and violate the spirit of the OMA ADA and the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. God bless Stormy Ray. I have a second thing to say, and that would be my own opinion. I should first introduce myself and my credentials. I've been a registered nurse for 32 years. serving health care in three countries and several of these United States, including above the Arctic Circle. And I'm a board member in the Stormy Ray Cartels Foundation. And just the one thing I want to say is when we say the term drug-free workplace, this is dishonoring classes that I've had as a nurse that mentioned that the title of the class is drugs. My nursing drug handbook is not a negative book, and I object to the term drug-free workplace. There's nothing wrong with the term drugs. You know, it's a simple scientific fact. Questions?
We'll take questions after the next witness testifies. Your name for the record, please.
My name is Clifford Spencer.
Mm-hmm.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity of giving me this. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to testify. HB 2693, 1 nor 2 represent neither sound science nor the will of the majority of Oregonians who voted to pass the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act of 1998. Registration in the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program should never be the sole cause for termination of employment. Use of medical marijuana within Oregon law should be treated like medical Marinol, medical Vicodin, and other medications both in and out of the workplace. The Oregon Medical Marijuana Act of 1998 states in 475.300, and I quote, "The people of the state of Oregon hereby find that, one, patients and doctors have found marijuana to be an effective treatment for suffering caused by debilitating medical conditions, and therefore marijuana should be treated like other medicines." I reference here page the last page where I make a number of footnotes as well as referral to various independent studies that have been conducted. Here I refer to the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. House Bill 2693, 1 and 2 discriminate in employment against Oregon medical marijuana patients without any scientific evidence to justify this discrimination. Testing urine for marijuana gives no indication whatsoever of impairment. Urine testing for marijuana only indicates past use. If I use medical marijuana today, and I do not use medical marijuana for a month, my urine can still test positive for marijuana. I seriously doubt if I used marijuana today, didn't use it again for a month, tested positive in my urine a month from now, I seriously doubt that I would be impaired. Although a blood test might screen more accurately, one would think, researchers conclude, quote, establishing a clear relation between THC plasma concentrations and clinical impairment will be much more difficult than for alcohol use. I make a reference to a study here. Alcohol and THC chemically are different and they metabolize differently. Daily cannabis users, like medical marijuana patients, sometimes have levels of 6 to 10 nanograms per milliliter without clinical impairment, even 24 hours or more after abstinence. Here I refer to several other studies. While science evolves, experts conclude it is premature to make conclusions about the proper cutoff levels using blood THC for driving under the influence suspicion. Make another reference to studies. While I recognize the desire for legislation to prohibit impairment in the workplace, HB 2693, 1 and 2 definitely are not it. Proper clinical observation for impairment remain the primary methods for monitoring for adverse reactions at this time. On a more personal note, I was one of the first patients to register with Oregon's Medical Marijuana Act. My qualifying conditions are severe chronic pain and persistent muscle spasms for her four herniated discs in my neck and less than successful surgeries for this condition. Because the psychoactive side effects of marijuana, for me, personally, I feel, get in the way of my full-time paid employment and my 40 hours a week of volunteer work assisting patients in residential care, people too ill or physically challenged to live on their own, with assistance in implementing Oregon's Medical Marijuana Act. I do not medicate during the day. I just grit and bear. It isn't easy. I live in pain with muscle spasms every second of every day. I medicate with medical marijuana at night when I get home. I find that if I use green medicine at night, I can control the pain and spasms and sleep, and the symptoms the next day are not as severe. I wake up in the morning, and after my morning cup of coffee, I'm functional and unimpaired. With most pharmaceutical prescriptions, the effects the next day were, in and of themselves, debilitating and impairing, even though there are no urine or blood tests to monitor the effects of muscle relaxers. In my paid employment, I'm entrusted with millions of dollars in merchandise. My employers are aware of my medical marijuana use, never during work, and are supportive. They concur that since I've been using this treatment modality in the evenings at home, my sales have increased substantially and I've missed fewer days of work. Legislation to discriminate in employment against employees like me who use this medicine responsibly should not be enacted. While I do see an intention to prohibit impairment in the workplace, HB 2693-1 and 2 will legislate employment discrimination against employees like me. Until science is involved to be able to address impairment from not past use of medical marijuana, we do not have the tools to address this without further research. Perhaps if House Bill 5077 does not bankrupt the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, we can begin funding this research. Now, I made some notes here regarding some previous testimony.
I have to ask you to summarize this fairly soon because we have four or five other bills. We haven't gone into work session on anything yet, so if you want to summarize that and we can copy your testimony for the record, we're happy to do that. I don't know how much more you have to go, but
it'll take just a couple of minutes.
Yeah, go ahead. That's fine.
Thank you.
We have to be in session in a little bit more than an hour, so we're getting time sensitive right now. Thank you.
Thank you. There was a reference to an FAA flight simulation study with pilots. That study was actually inconclusive. There were several more studies after that that discredited that particular study. Cognitive reasoning studies indicate that there is no long-term effect from using medical marijuana. Matter of fact, the federal government had a number of people who have been using medical marijuana given to them by the National Institute of Health for 20 years. They were thoroughly tested, and there was no cognitive impairment after 8 hours of use. There was a reference to the potency of marijuana, and there's a rather important bit of information regarding potencies. THC is only one cannabinoid in marijuana. There are an estimated 50 different cannabinoids in marijuana. THC is the only one that's being tested for. Different cannabinoids do different things. For example, some cannabinoids are more effective for pain, some more effective for muscle spasms. THC is more effective for its psychoactive properties. And the patients that I work with are a lot more interested in pain relief, for example, or muscle spasms relief, or prevention of seizures than they are the psychoactive properties. There was a reference to the federal ruling. And basically, the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act only exempts people from local prosecution. That's all it's ever done. That's all it does today. Someone quoted, this law was passed for those too sick to work. And I refer you to the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. The Oregon Medical Marijuana Act was for people with severe debilitating conditions. It wasn't for people too sick to work. I ask you, do not pass on House Bill 2693. It's discriminatory. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Spencer, just a quick question. I appreciate your testimony and some points. What do you suggest for the employer to do then with the employee who's impaired?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Olson, I wish I had a good answer for you. My opponents here and I agree that we don't necessarily want impairment in the workplace. However, my position is I don't want discrimination in the workplace either. And in my last sentence of the written testimony on the top of the first page, basically what I'm saying is at this time, there are no accurate tests to determine impairment in the workplace other than clinical observations. And I think the police officer might have some direction in that area because I know that they do field sobriety tests for impairment. But at this point, there are no clear-cut tests either for urine or blood that would indicate impairment versus past use. The only thing blood tests and urine analyses do are test for past use. They don't test for impairment. Okay. So I wish I had an answer for you. I don't.
Okay, further questions from the committee? Okay, thank you. Seeing none, then you're excused right now. Are there any other persons wishing to testify on House Bill 2693? I see a hand up in the audience. Would like to come forward? I don't think you're on my witness list, and but that's okay. We just need your name for the record, please.
My name is Erin Hildebrand. I submitted written testimony the last time, but you ran out of you decided to postpone the hearing, and so I wasn't able to speak then.
Okay.
I'll keep this really short because I know that you're under a time crunch. Those are my five children in the back there, and so I'm kind of I'm working right now. I'm doing double duty here. And I have used medical marijuana this morning. If I hadn't used it, the spasms would be so bad that I would be completely doubled over and I wouldn't be able to speak to you. It's made such a huge difference in my life. It takes away pain. It takes away nausea. Without it, I would spend my mornings, for the most part, throwing up and being in the bathroom. There were many times that my kids would come up to me and ask for a hug, and there wasn't much I could do. You know, when your head's in the toilet, not really the time to give the kids a hug. You were speaking about the impairment testing, and when I spoke with a drug recognition expert, Sergeant Malloy at Newport High School, about Measure 33 last year, he was complaining that there were no tests for impairment, and I asked him, well, what would you do if somebody was taking a muscle relaxer or Benadryl? And he said, well, I'd do a field sobriety test. I said, well, that makes sense. Okay, maybe we need to develop field sobriety tests for the workplace. I don't know, but I agree with Clifford Spencer that we can't allow discrimination either. I think that we're looking at a serious danger if we start infringing on people's rights based on the medicine that their doctors recommend they take. And I know for my husband, we were very concerned when he went to look for a new job because we didn't know whether or not he would test positive for some sort of THC metabolites. Because he has to help me sometimes. You know, he holds my hair back when I'm throwing up. And if there's smoke in the room, he might inhale some of it, and we weren't sure what would happen. We were lucky that he found an employer that was very understanding, but if you allow employers to make that choice on their own, I don't know that all of them will choose to be so understanding. So please, kill this bill and preserve our rights to work and take care of our families. Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? I thank you for your testimony. Further witnesses on House Bill 2693. I have a question of the proponents, if they'd like to come forward or just for a second. Proponents. Let me give you a shot at this one. I'm looking at line 11. In the use of the word accommodate medical use of marijuana, I'm trying to figure out whether you mean tolerate it or whether you mean accommodate within the terms of the Disability Act. I'm trying to understand the consequences of accommodating medical use of marijuana. What are the consequences to the employee or the employer? The word accommodate to me has a specific meaning with respect to the Oregon Disabilities Act. And I'm wondering what we mean by that. In other words, can you say, using the word accommodation, that your application is denied because you test positive for marijuana? Or does it mean that I, as an employee, am still subject to being employed, but I can't use my marijuana use as a claim for that I'm disabled?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, maybe I'll take the first stab at that. Again, I think in my prior conversation with Mr. Sears, there's a certain ambiguity in that phrase, and I guess I was construing it as in a more narrow sense, and that is that the employer doesn't need to do anything affirmatively to facilitate, to allow, to accommodate the medical use of marijuana in a different location, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the employer would have the authority to terminate or discipline an employee who, on his own time at a different location, was using legitimate medical use of marijuana and coming to work non-impaired. I might suggest to the committee that evidently everybody is construing that phrase differently, and it may be worthwhile for the committee to come to a determination politically which way you want this to read, which rule you want to adopt, and to clarify the language to make crystal clear whether or not you want to enable employers to discipline and terminate people who are legitimately using marijuana off the workplace and are coming to work without impairment but still have metabolites in their blood, as will be shown by a blood test.
Employer representatives, what do you feel about that? Again, the consequences of the word accommodate.
In my opinion, until there are better tests to know the level of impairment, it is very difficult to put that burden on an employer to determine when someone can and cannot work. It might be different in an office environment, but certainly in safety-sensitive situations, until those tests are devised, I would suggest no use, no accommodation for medical marijuana in safety-sensitive jobs. That's my stance.
But under my hypothetical, if I apply for work, a production job with your company, and I test positive, but I'm not impaired, does that mean that, A, I would not be considered for employment whatever, or B, if I was an employee, I would be fired?
If you tested positive?
Yes, sir. I'm not impaired.
Positive, non-impaired would be difficult for me to answer because I don't know what level of positive test would have to be judged for impairment. At this time, I would say a positive drug test would yield no employment or termination of employment.
Okay. Further explanation on that?
Well, Mr. Chair, not every employer is obligated to comply with the drug-free workplace. But many employers, because of the safety-sensitive nature of their business, implements a drug-free workplace policy. So I think that accommodate is used in the current statute as well, and it's also in the -2 amendments.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I have one of my issues with this is, you know, the term discrimination keeps coming up. We don't allow Vicodin. We don't allow prescription drugs. We don't allow alcohol in our workplace either. This is the only drug that I cannot monitor, regulate, is marijuana because of the Medical Marijuana Act. I'm not asking to treat anybody differently. I want to treat everybody the same. In safety-sensitive jobs, I can't have any level of impairment.
Okay, thank you. Representative McPherson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, my reading of both the -1 and -2 amendments, as I studied more closely, is that because of the new subsection 3 that's at the end of both of them, and it's the same text, I think that allows an employer to establish a drug-free workplace policy that would be triggered by a positive test, whether current impairment had occurred or not. The impairment language is in Section 2, and it's expressed differently in the, or fully in the -2s, but I don't read either one of these amendments as not allowing, that is, I read them both as enabling an employer to establish a drug-free workplace that would be triggered by a test that is positive for historic use of marijuana. And I think that's the policy question, is make it clarify the law so that the employers are enabled to establish that kind of policy and enforce it, given that the statute doesn't require them to do so. An employer can make a choice, and employees can work out an accommodation. They can approach their employer and describe their medical condition, and in many instances where it's a productive employee, I would expect that the employer would decide to allow it.
Okay, further comments from the committee? Again, for answering the questions. I think as long as we have a quorum here, I'm going to work into the work sessions that I have, or that we can accommodate at this. I guess accommodations on my mind, huh? So while we have a quorum, let's do. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2693 and open a work session on House Bill 2247, and that will require the adoption, I believe, of the Dash 1 amendments. Do I have a motion? Is there a floor?
Mr. Chair, I would move adoption of the Dash. I would move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2247.
Representative Flores moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2247. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, that's allowed. Representative?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2247 to the full committee with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Flores moves that House Bill 2247 as amended be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion from the committee? Seeing none, the clerk may call a roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard, excuse, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Representative Ward?
Excuse.
Representative Ritter?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 2247 is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Representative Flores will be the carrier, and a work session on that bill is concluded. Thank you. We'll move into a. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 181A. Counsel?
Chair Ackerman, members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 181A comes to you from the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. This was before the Civil Subcommittee on the 27th and was before the full committee, House Judiciary, on the 3rd of June. And at that time, there were concerns raised about a case, Curtis v. Lampert, from 171 ORAP 336, 2000 case, that it was asserted by opponents of the bill, made the bill unconstitutional. The measure itself would provide that the court would have the ability to decline to waive or defer the filing fees or court costs for an inmate who is a plaintiff in an action against a public body if the court reviews the pleadings and finds that those pleadings fail to state a claim. The current law is at ORS 30.643, and under the current law, when an inmate is making a claim against a public body, the only thing the court can consider in determining whether or not to waive the claim is the inmate's financial situation. So what this bill would do would allow an additional criteria for the court to determine to decide not to waive the filing fees, and that is if the court reviewed the pleadings and found that the pleadings were deficient. So the committee asked me to review the Curtis v. Lampert case, which I did. I provided a written opinion to Chair Krieger and Chair Ackerman, Representative McPherson, and I determined that that case does not provide a legal basis to conclude that Senate Bill 181A would be impermissible. Exactly what that case did was, in a situation where under the current statute, where the court can only use the financial ability of the inmate plaintiff, that judge in State v. Lambert made a decision based on the merits of the case. And when that went up on appeal, the Court of Appeals reversed, saying the statute doesn't give you authority to decide the fee waiver on anything else. So the reason that's an opposite is because this bill would provide the authority for the court to do exactly what the court didn't have authority to do in Curtis v. Lampert. I did uncover some other cases, specifically Stanwood versus Multnomah County, 135 ORAP 58, and Voth versus Snake River Correctional Institution, 171 ORAP 392, which do suggest that under the Oregon Constitution there is a right to a fee waiver. However, the U.S. Supreme Court under the United States Constitution has only ruled that due process requires an absolute fee waiver in the case of domestic relations matters, which this is not. With that background, I've advised Chair Krieger that Judge Terry Leggert from Marion County, who's the proponent of the bill, is here, as is Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center.
Fine. I think what we'll do, since we're in work session, we can only have invited testimony, but I'll invite each of you to come forward right now. And while you are assembling, let me ask counsel to summarize the, do you have the dash twos and the dash threes?
Thank you, Chair Ackerman. There are those two amendments before you. These were the amendments that were suggested by Sybil Hebb of the Oregon Law Center. The dash two amendment would add to the bill by creating an extension of the statute of limitations if the court were to review the pleadings, determine that they failed to state a claim, and would deny the fee as a result. If that waiver denial judgment happened within 30 days of the expiration of the statute of limitations, the statute would automatically be extended for 45 additional days. The intent of that is to allow the inmate plaintiff to cure his or her pleadings and not get closed out by virtue of the statute of limitations. Then separately, the A3 amendment would require that when the court made this decision that the pleadings failed to state a claim, the judgment document, that is the piece of paper that the court uses to deny the fee waiver, would have to include the court's findings as to why the pleadings failed to state a claim. I believe the intent behind that is, again, to assist the inmate plaintiff in determining what he or she did wrong and give them an opportunity to fix their pleading.
Thank you for those explanations. You may proceed in any manner you wish.
For the record, I'm Terry Leggert. I'm a judge here in Marion County, and I want to thank you for giving me a chance to testify here, Chair Ackerman and members of the committee. I know you've changed your policy where you get 48 hours before a hearing set, but our courts are set weeks and weeks in advance. In fact, I have a pro tem during my docket this morning. I'd just like to say this particular proposal came out of the governor's task force. I was a member along with all the other that included people from every walk of arena dealing with criminal law, and it's a subcommittee on adjudications. Being in Marion County, we get a lot of inmate litigation, and interestingly, Mr. Voss' name, he's what we call a frequent flyer, is an inmate that we see frequently filing frivolous litigation. A couple things I wanted to point out. One is we treat inmates differently already. Currently, if an inmate's had three previous lawsuits dismissed because they were frivolous, the next one he or she has to pay a filing fee, whether it's frivolous or not. The second thing, as a judge, we get very frustrated at, maybe because I'm impotent is what you feel, when you have to grant a fee waiver, knowing that the state and whoever else has been sued by the inmate might not just be a state person. We've had inmates sue school districts, personal employees. They have to file an answer, so you have to have an attorney be paid to do something in response to it. Otherwise, under civil laws, I'm sure you're aware, a default is entered, and then a judgment is entered. We have no control over that either. But knowing that the lawsuit's frivolous, we have to do a fee waiver if the person can't afford it. And that's just the way the statute's currently written. So first of all, we treat inmates differently already. Secondly, it seems ridiculous to allow a fee waiver on something you know is going to turn around and get dismissed under a Rule 21 motion. Now, oftentimes, currently, the AG's office, when there's multiple litigants, there's an agreement, and I'm not sure exactly how it worked out, because officially they can't represent somebody who's not a state person, agrees to go forward trying to get the lawsuit dismissed without the private people paying money, hiring lawyers, to increase the cost of the litigation for the other named defendants. I will say the inmates, not surprisingly, people that are in custody for long periods of time have nothing else to do. There's a very active legal department at the state penitentiary, and they have to allow them access to law books, so they just file lawsuits routinely on lots of things. So this is one way just to reduce it, the cost of this litigation to the state and to private individuals. I'd object to both of the amendments because they would give inmates more rights than private citizens have. If you're a private citizen and you file a lawsuit within 30 days statute of limitation and you don't state a claim and the defense attorney says that and your lawsuit's dismissed, you cannot refile that lawsuit. The court can give you the option of filing an additional, allowing you to replead, but they don't have to. So we'd be giving inmates a right that private, that non-inmates don't have. The second amendment is the same thing. We do not explain to litigants, we do not give them legal advice, what's the problem with their lawsuit. If we dismiss it because it doesn't state a claim, we dismiss it. And the judge is in a position to explain that. So both of those things would be actually giving inmates more rights. It would also be used, I can tell you, to delay and delay and delay. And particularly in terms of this 45-day rule, they'll just continually be filing things and asking for those extensions. They can just extend that ad infinitum as far as I can tell. I have discussed this issue prior to actually coming before the subcommittee, discussed it procedurally with the Court of Appeals justices in terms of I was concerned about whether we might increase their caseload on these fee waivers and having to look behind the complaints, and they didn't have a problem with it. And lastly, I was going to say the federal judges have many defendants who, again, we call them frequent flyers, people that file lawsuit after lawsuit, that they do pre-judgment filing where they review the pleadings of the litigants and will not let them file those pleadings when they are frivolous. So we're trying to parrot some good practices in federal law.
Thank you, Judge. I'll take Ms. Hebb's testimony. I think these amendments are hers. I think we understand them. Did you have anything else you want to add, particularly to the judge's comments?
Thank you, Chair Ackerman and members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center. And I just have a couple of points to make in response to some of the comments made by Judge Legard. And before I do that, I want to express how very much we appreciate the concern about frivolous lawsuits and respect those concerns. And we have a great respect for, of course, preserving the integrity of our judicial resources here in the state. And that is as of great concern to our clients as it is to other people using the judicial system. So I do respect those concerns. The concern that we have about the way that this particular bill will the concern about the particular bill is that we think it will have a substantive impact on only low-income inmates' abilities to address their claims. And I disagree that that the amendments would give greater rights to inmates than to other people. The concern I have about the bill is that it raises statutes of limitations issues. If, for example, let's consider a meritorious case that an inmate doesn't know how to file appropriately. For example, there's been an assault against an inmate by a prison guard. I don't mean to suggest that happens all the time, and clearly that's not the case. But there are sometimes meritorious cases brought by inmates. And unfortunately, many inmates are low income, and many inmates are proceeding pro se. That's probably got a great deal to do with the fact that there are frivolous lawsuits, but there are sometimes meritorious cases in which inmates are filing pleadings in which they have not had the benefit of legal counsel, and they get it wrong. And so they file their pleadings, and they don't state a claim because, for example, one common mistake that's made is that an inmate frequently doesn't understand that in a Section 1983 civil rights claim, they may not name the county as a defendant. They need to name the individual who caused their injuries. Frequently, as I understand it, in federal courts, a number of cases are dismissed because the county is named instead of the particular individual, and it's a common mistake. If a high-income inmate makes those filings if the bill passes, then the high-income inmate may file the pleadings and will then have the right. And it's actually a right. It's not at the court's discretion. It's a right. Within 20, before the responsive pleading is filed, that inmate may go back and amend his pleadings to correct those errors. And this bill would deprive a low-income inmate's ability to correct those errors. I do agree that the federal courts have been able to address this circumstance by pre-sort of screening pleadings before they're filed. The distinction is that in federal courts, there are law clerks who basically screen for the existence of meritorious claims and are able to refer low-income inmates to a standing committee of counsel who are volunteering to address pro se, to address inmate claims, low-income inmate claims. And a member of our firm is a member of that committee, and he frequently gets calls from federal law clerks who have said, you know, this claim does, these pleadings don't state a claim, but we think there's something here. Can you give this person advice? If we're not taking that extra step in the way that the federal courts are, I don't think that the structure that we're setting up is adequately mirroring the federal structure.
Well, we have to ask you to conclude now because we're, again, running out of time.
I appreciate that. I would just indicate that we're supportive of any efforts to try to reduce frivolous claims so long as they don't have an impartial or a disparate impact on low-income people on the basis of their income.
Okay, we'll take questions from the, thank you. Take questions from the committee. Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, thanks. Just a real quick question, Judge Legert. What's the cost for to file a claim like this? I have no idea.
Okay. Chair, thanks, and Representative Olson and members of the committee. It depends county to county, but we're talking about around $100, but it's not, we don't say that the person has to pay the whole amount up front. We're just trying to put them on payment plans. They just want their fees totally waived so they have to pay nothing. And that's what we're trying to get away from. And when we do that, as my testimony that they submitted, they usually don't want to bother because most of these, if it's totally frivolous and it's for harassment purposes, they don't want to pay to play.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions?
Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
Judge Legert, with respect to the Dash 2 amendment on the extension of the statute of limitations, how burdensome would it be on the court to include this amendment, to say, okay, it gets a little extra time? I heard your comment about the potential that somebody could keep refiling and always failing to state a claim and never running out of the time of their action, but I guess on that particular point, how troublesome would it be if we were to adopt the Dash 2 amendment to this bill?
Chair Ackerman, Representative McPherson, members of the committee, I suppose you could make it a one-time thing, which would mean you'd change it, just say you'd have one chance to do it right. So that might not be burdensome, so they couldn't continually end up in that loop. But my concern is the fairness to other litigants don't have that. And why should an inmate have a different right that a private citizen, everybody else doesn't have? I don't want to create additional rights for inmates because they already know how to exploit the ones they have. But anyways, that's the point I was trying to make on that. I don't think it can become endless litigation. I would just suggest that if you do it, that you say one time, fine, refile. But I will say that Ms. Hebb said if there hasn't been a responsive pleading filed, and the defendant is only going to know his pleading is inadequate in the normal course of things if the opponent has already filed a pleading and said there's something the matter with it. We're telling you something matter with it. If you're within 30 days of filing, you need to replead it now. That's all we're saying. Do it now and you try it again. Pay your filing fee. Or pay your filing fee to file this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Okay, hearing none, you're excused. Thank you again for your testimony. We're still in work session on Senate Bill 181, and we have the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments before us. I guess our choices are to just forward the bill up and take the amendments later or take the amendments now. You want to, Chair Krieger, do you have any?
If the committee is satisfied with them and you can put them in now, that's fine, whichever one. I didn't hear all the testimony because I was downstairs, so I'll leave it up to you what you want to move.
Okay, I'll wait for a motion on...
Well, let me offer up some views here on the amendments, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please, on the amendments.
It seems to me that the Dash 3 amendments requiring the court to state why the pleading failed to state a claim, seems to me the judge's point that that's something that is not required when a case is dismissed and for other litigants is a telling point, and so I would be inclined not to pursue the Dash 3 amendments. The Dash 2 amendments, the extension of the statute of limitations, I think it's kind of a theoretical issue, probably not too likely that these things are going to arise when the statute is about to run, but the idea of extending it for a 45-day period, that doesn't seem like it's such a terrible burden to the court to do that. I think the judge's suggestion of a one-shot correction time rather than having it go into an endless loop of continuing extensions is probably a good one. So we don't, maybe we don't have the version of the amendment that would be most recommended here in front of us, but I would be inclined to pursue that amendment, and maybe the thing to do is to move this up to full with that adjustment made in the dash two amendments so that they could be adopted in full.
Well, then I would say perhaps a consensus is that we move the bill and we not move the amendments, with the understanding that council would submit an amendment to the dash two consistent with Representative McPherson's remarks. Would that be a consensus, committee?
Mr. Chair, I would agree with moving it without either of the amendments. I would just question Representative McPherson that if the dash threes were to be moved and not the dash twos, would that not give the cure that is required within the same 30-day time frame as opposed to extending the 30-day time frame to 45 days?
The my reading of the dash threes is that they really go to quite a different issue. That is, that the dash three requires that the court's finding on why the pleadings fail a stated claim for which legal relief may be granted has to be stated
in a special document.
Yeah, right, and that, so it doesn't really deal with the statute of limitations issue. They're really two independent issues. I mean, the dash threes that address the problem that the pro se litigant doesn't know why it is that the complaint failed to state a claim, and the dash two amendments deal with the problem that they claim may be filed very close to the end of the running of the statute of limitations, so they're out of court and they've lost their claim by the time they know that they have failed to state a claim. So I think they're two independent issues. I found the dash three issue not something that seemed to me was compelling to adopt. The dash two seemed like there was a rationale for.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I find it interesting that I am not given the same rights that the dash two provide for a window period.
Thank you. Okay, further discussion from the committee.
I guess, Mr. Chair, that would be my overriding concern. I would be more inclined to support the dash twos with a limitation on how many times that 45.
Right. Well, the dash twos are going to have to take another amendment. Then it would not be my desire to move the dash threes on the basis of the discussion. So what we're left with is just passing the bill to the full committee subject to one amendment.
Well, I think what's being suggested is moving it without an amendment, and then we can, and I think there's some, there's probably a fuller discussion to have about whether even to adopt the revised dash twos. It's not what I'm hearing. Mm-hmm. There's some a perspective that maybe we don't even need any amendment.
Yeah, we're not moving any amendment now, but we would have one in the box at the full committee.
Right. I think we should do that so we have it available to discuss in full and decide whether or not we want to adopt that amendment.
That's fine. Take a motion then on Senate Bill 181. Chair will move that Senate Bill 181 be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Hearing none, the clerk will call a roll, please.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gillard excused. Representative Worth excused. Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Senate Bill 181 is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. With the understanding, we'll have a backup amendment for the dash two. With that, I'll conclude the work session on Senate Bill 181. A work session on Senate Bill 236.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 236 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission, clarifies that a civil action for discrimination of place of public accommodation or civil action for aiding and abetting discrimination of place of public accommodation must be commenced for 1 year of the occurrence of the unlawful practice. No amendments, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill was before you on the 8th of June for a public hearing.
Thank you. Is there, I guess before we have a discussion on the bill, I will entertain a motion to on Senate Bill 236.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 236 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves Senate Bill 236 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion from the remnants of our committee? The bare quorum? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Girard excused. Representative Worth excused. Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. Senate Bill 236 is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and the work session on that bill is concluded. Open a work session on House Bill 2912. Council.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2912 was heard before this committee May 2nd. This bill prohibits a public body from substantially burdening a person's free exercise of religion, including when the burden results from the application of a rule of general applicability, unless the body meets the burden of providing evidence and persuading the trier of fact that the imposition of the burden furthers a compelling government interest and is the least restrictive means of furthering that compelling government interest. It provides that a prohibition does not apply to burdens imposed on persons due to application of certain land use statutes, goals, or regulations. Authorizes a civil action for the act. This bill, again, was in response to a Supreme Court decision in 1990, I believe, Smith, which came out of Oregon. That case changed how the Supreme Court analyzes the free exercise claims. Simply put, the pre-Smith standard had a threshold of substantial burden. If a law poses a substantial burden on an individual's religion, then the court would use a strict scrutiny test. For all practical purposes, if the court uses a strict scrutiny test, that law is going to fail. Now, the post-Smith standard changed that to look at the law. That was the threshold issue. If it was a law of general applicability, they didn't look at the burden it placed on the person's religion, but if it was a law of general applicability, that is, it applied to everybody equally, the court would use a rational basis test. For all practical purposes, a rational basis test is always going to pass. That is, the law will not be struck down. So that is, this bill, 2912, would go back to the pre-Smith standard, which is where the courts would look at the burden it places on the individual's religion and apply strict scrutiny depending on what that burden was.
Is there a motion so we can have a discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2912 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves that House Bill 2912 be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Council, does this change the current constitutional test on these issues?
Yes, it would. It would allow the state, if I can go back a step, after the Smith decision, Congress passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the RFRA. That act brought back the pre-Smith standard. That act was subsequently, that was a federal act, it was subsequently found unconstitutional as applied to the states, violated, separation of power principles. So basically that is the federal standard now according to that federal law. If the states want to bring back that pre-Smith standard, they have to pass laws such as this one in 2912, which would be equivalent or similar to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So under current law, under current Oregon law, we use, or the courts would analyze, the federal courts would analyze the free exercise cases using general applicability standard, and if this bill passes, it would change how the courts would interpret that law or analyze free exercise cases.
If this changes the Smith decision, is not the bill subject to, if a statute, if an act, is subject to constitutional challenge?
It would not be subject to constitutional challenge, I think, because it would go beyond. The federal constitution is providing a floor that states cannot go beyond, fall under, and this would be, I guess, above that. So it wouldn't be unconstitutional to that effect.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Question of counsel, once again, how many other states have a state religious freedom restoration act on the books?
I'm not sure, but I think it's 11 or 12. I think Mr. Gonzalez would be able to answer. I think it's there's a handful of states. It might be 13. It's somewhere around there.
And a follow-up question?
Yes.
And they have been found to be constitutional pursuant to the United States Supreme Court decision.
I'm not sure if there's been a specific decision, but if this was unconstitutional, then it would have been found so. The RFRA, the federal act, would have been found unconstitutional as it applies to both the federal government and the states on the basis of the First Amendment. It was not, so that would lead me to believe that those challenges are not going to be made. There's not going to be a challenge in that regard.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions for discussion, I guess, with the committee.
Mr. Chair, question for counsel. The Smith case address both the religious exercise provisions of the federal and the state constitution, or is it just the federal constitution?
It's my understanding that it was just the federal constitution. We had discussion, testimony regarding the Oregon, the standard in the Oregon constitution. There's not clarity on that. I believe that the first time around there was testimony that the Oregon Constitution went further, and that it did. I'm sorry. The first time around, I believe that we were told that the Oregon Constitution applied the Smith standard, so that it was similar to the federal standard now. Later on, there was testimony that indicated that maybe the Oregon Constitution went further than the federal constitution. I specifically asked what exactly was the standard, and the person testifying did not know. So it's I'm unclear what exactly how far the Oregon Constitution goes, and we didn't have testimony, I think, conclusively stating one way or the other.
Okay. Further questions?
Well, by way of discussion, Mr. Chair, it seems like there are a lot of uncertainties about the constitutional analysis in which the bill arises, and as according to my notes, quite a bit of resistance from particularly local governments about the potential impacts, because the bill is quite broad, quite hard to tell what impacts it might have. And I'd have to say from my own notes again, while there were strong advocates for it, not very compelling arguments as to why it was needed. Mm-hmm. So I'd have to say we've got a difficult constitutional analysis and the potential for ramifications we don't fully understand, and not a very compelling case made for creating this law change would be my reaction.
Yeah, I appreciate your comments, Representative. Is there further discussion on the bill? Okay, hearing none, I'm going to call for the vote. I'm going to give this bill a courtesy yes, because I want it reviewed by the full committee. I'm probably a no on the merits. May I call the roll, please?
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard, excused. Representative Lewis, excused. Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Senate Bill 181 is forwarded to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation. Oops, I'm sorry. I'm one behind. House Bill 2912 is forwarded to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation, and I will conclude the work session on that bill. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Return to House Bill 2693. We had a public hearing this morning, and I will open a work session on House Bill 2693. need a motion before we can have discussion.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. What was your motion? What were you doing? I missed because I was talking. Have you moved the bill or went to a work session or anything? Or?
We're in a work session on House Bill 2693.
Okay, thank you.
And I'm waiting for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2693. Are we doing any?
Well, we need amendments. We need either the dash 2 or the dash 3 amendments because it's a gotten stuff.
Okay. Let me get oriented.
The dash 1 and dash 2 amendments are before the
I beg your pardon. Dash 1 or dash 2.
Right.
And the difference between them is that the dash 2s have a longer version of this subsection 2 at the end that instead of just the limited phrase that's in the dash 1s about that the Medical Marijuana Act doesn't require an employer to accommodate the medical use of marijuana, it would flesh that out by adding the phrase regardless of where the use occurs, and it would add a B and a C to 2, which refer to impairment. I still, as I indicated earlier, read both amendments as allowing an employer to establish a drug-free workplace and to have sanctions or refusal to hire for people who test positive even if they're not impaired. That's how I read subsection 3 in both amendments.
I agree with that assessment, Representative McPherson. I know there's some disagreement on that point with Mr. Sylvester of DOJ. I just want to point out in the Washburn decision, the issue of accommodation came up, whether the employer had to accommodate the use of medical marijuana in the workplace as the current law is. That court looked at the definition use of medical marijuana, and it went through each point, possessing and using, and it said that the employer could not show that the employee did one of those things in the workplace, therefore the employer did not have to, therefore the employer did have to accommodate, and it sent it back down to the lower court. What I read from that is that if the employer could have shown that one of those things happened in the workplace, that the employer therefore would not have accommodated the employee, that means that case would have been dismissed on summary judgment. That was a case under the Disabilities Act. The employee was fired because metabolites were found in the employee's system, and then the employee brought a case under the Oregon Disabilities Act. So I don't know if that clarifies that term accommodate, but I think what is clear from that is that if the term as it's proposed to be changed in the dash 2 amendments, if the term in the workplace is taken out and replaced with regardless of where it occurs, then the court is going to look and see if the employer did in fact participate in the use of medical marijuana. It doesn't have, the employer is not limited to show that happened in the workplace. And I think it's clear that if there's metabolites in your system, that the medical use of marijuana has happened. And I think that's just because you've used medical marijuana. That's how I would analyze that provision.
I agree. I think that actually the dash 2 amendments, because of the addition of the phrase regardless of where the use occurs, are actually broader in allowing the employer to prescribe, to limit or to sanction against the use.
I believe that to be the case as well. I just wanted to point out as well another purpose to the dash 2 amendments. The dash 1 amendments, if you notice, add a definition to medical use of marijuana as including having evidence of marijuana in the person's system. That phrase was removed because of there's another part in the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act that says that an individual who may not participate in the medical use of marijuana in public, and if this phrase was left in, there may have been some conflict between the criminal laws and the medical use of marijuana, because criminal laws do not include, under possessing marijuana, including having evidence of marijuana as one system. So there was a possible conflict. The outcome may have been that anybody who had marijuana in their system could not go out into public, and then there would have been maybe problems with conflicts with how criminal law interacted with that. So in order to kind of remove that from this bill, that phrase was taken out, which that would obviously very clearly state that, yes, medical use of marijuana does mean having metabolites in the system, but then in having that more clear in that regard would then maybe pose a problem for other areas in the criminal law. That's why that term was taken out, and in the dash twos, the term, regardless of where the use occurs, was added to further clarify that point.
Well, I guess my recommendation to the subcommittee would be adopting the dash two amendments and then moving the bill.
Yes, I concur in that. I think that in the dash one amendments, medical use of marijuana included having evidence of marijuana in the person's system, and that language is not repeated in the dash twos. In fact, dash two narrows that down just to the words to possess, unquote, which I think means physical possession rather than having substance in your bloodstream. So I think to some extent that's a narrowing, but I still have some worry about what the word accommodate means, is whether that's used within the context of our disability statutes or whether it means means something else, where you could just fire someone at will for having marijuana in their system, even though they may not be impaired or may not be using the substance in the workplace. I think it's I'll just leave it at that. I do favor the dash twos for the reasons expressed, but I have some reservation, might require some clarification later on. Is there further discussion on the dash twos? We have a motion on that.
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2693.
Representative Flores moves that the dash two amendments be incorporated within House Bill 2693. Further discussion from the committee? Objections? Hearing none? It's allowed. Motion on the bill is amended.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2693 to the full committee with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Flores moves House Bill 2693 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Of course, that's as amended. Is there discussion from the committee? I will extend a yes vote, but I may vote no on the merits later. I call the roll for no further discussion.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard excused. Representative Wood excused. Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
House Bill 2693, as amended, is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and the work session on that bill is concluded. We down to 87?
Yeah.
Okay. Open a work session on House Bill 2873. Council?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2873 provides that the definitions of the Oregon Disabilities Act shall be construed consistently to the extent possible with similar provisions of the Federal Americans with Disabilities Act. This bill is in response also to the Washburn versus Columbia Forest Products case. In that case, the court held that mitigating measures could not be used to determine whether a person was disabled. Now, federal law allows courts to use mitigating measures by allowing courts to construe consistently the state and federal laws. That would mean that the Oregon courts could use mitigating measures to determine whether somebody is disabled. An example of where that happened was the Sutton case in federal law. Airplane pilots who require glasses to see made a claim that they were disabled. The court held that by merely not being able to see, that these people were not disabled. The courts allowed basically look to the mitigating measures, which means the glasses those pilots used, and said those people are not disabled. So that's a kind of situation where it came up. arguably, if a court is not using mitigating measures, as it would not, as it is not now under Oregon law, the definition of disability would be broader. Theoretically, I suppose I could have a claim for disability because I have glasses. I mean, because I can't see if the circumstances were as they were in the Sutton case. But that is the change that this bill would be making. It would be putting the federal standard back in Oregon law.
Okay, I have several witnesses, and we have an extreme time limitation, but I want to get as much in as we possibly can. I have four people. I think we'll just have you all come up at once in the interest of saving some time. Stephanie Taylor, Tina Treasure, Lisa Trussell, and Kevin O'Reilly. That support the bill to go first. I know that would be Ms. Trussell. The rest of you are against the bill. Is that my understanding? Okay. Ms. Trussell will go first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with AOI, and I've handed to the committee staff testimony in support of the bill from Paula Barron, who's unable to be here today, and the committee administrator, Mr. Sears, correctly analyzed the need for the bill to put Oregon's disability laws in lockstep with the ADA, and for those reasons, we would ask for your positive support of the Dash 2 amendments. Also, I would like to note that AGC is supportive of this as well.
Fine, thank you. We have three of you left. Who would like to go first? You may proceed.
Good morning, Chair Ackerman. For the record, my name is Stephanie Parrish Taylor, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services. I'm here to testify in opposition to House Bill 2873-1 amendments and to express our concerns about the HB 2873-2 amendments. For reference, I am attaching our testimony in opposition to HB 2873 from the initial hearing in March. HB 2873 amends OAR S659A.106. It reduces the strength of our current state non-discrimination law. The bill lowers the current threshold and prohibits employment discrimination against persons with disabilities to employers that employ 15 or more persons rather than the current provision of 6 or more persons. HB 2873-1 retains the initial language from HB 2873 and additionally amends 659A.139 by adding to the definition section 659A.100, language that is currently found in 659A.139, quote, shall be construed to the extent possible in a manner that is consistent with any similar provisions of the Federal Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990 as amended, unquote. DHS continues to oppose this attempt to dilute Oregon's non-discrimination statute as it relates to employment of people with disabilities. HB 2873-2 amends OARS 659.A100 by adding to the definition section 659A.100 language that is currently is found in 659A.139. quote, shall be construed to the extent possible in a manner that is consistent with any similar provisions of the Federal Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990 as amended, unquote. DHS is unclear why this is being proposed and has not taken a position as a result. Given these concerns, the Department opposes HB 2873-1 amendments and has taken no position on HB 2873-2. Thank you for the opportunity to present testimony. I'm available to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. I think realistically we have about 10 minutes left, and it appears to be that we may not get through with this bill, and unfortunately we'll bring it back up. I mean, not unfortunately we'll bring it back. Unfortunately we can't get to it, but if we have to do that, we'll try to move it to the top of the docket next time and make sure you're given a priority status for testimony if you don't make it today. Please proceed.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Kevin O'Reilly. I'm here today representing the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America. And we oppose the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments just as we opposed the original bill. We're not really too sure why the Dash 2, what issue the Dash 2 amendments are trying to address. Again, we've heard reference to the a court case revolving the use of medical marijuana, and we feel that the Dash 2 amendments don't necessarily address this issue, and if they attempt to address it, they don't do it very well, and that there might be better means of addressing the issue of safety in the workplace and employees who may use medical marijuana, and just this doesn't get there. As a suggestion, because I've been thinking about this for way too long, if the use of medical marijuana is an issue that seems to be everyone's very concerned with, and this bill seems to be trying to address that more than anything, it might be helpful if the Association of Oregon Industries and Foley and possibly even OSHA and other players in this particular issue got together and worked out something. It's going to be a long, drawn-out process to get good answers to this issue. And they need to come together, and they need to work together. It just seems to make sense that way. And possibly next session they can come forward with something that really starts to answer some questions. Have some good answers.
Thank you. Next witness, please.
Tara Ackerman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tina Treasure. I'm the director of the State Independent Living Council, and I'm here today to testify at their direction in opposition to HB 2873 in its entirety, including Dash 1 and 2 amendments, which seems to be at issue here today. The Oregon State Independent Living Council's federally mandated council that was established by executive order in 1992 as a result of the 1992 amendments to the Rehab Act. The council consists of up to 21 governor-appointed disability advocates who work together with Centers for Independent Living and other partners to promote the SILC mission of choice, equal access, and full inclusion of people with disabilities throughout the state of Oregon. In the SILC's role of furthering independence of persons with disabilities, we felt we had to speak out in strong opposition to any attempt to reduce the opportunity for us to engage in competitive employment. When the unemployment rate of persons with disabilities remains at around 70%, this bill would reduce the number of employers covered by non-discrimination provisions from more than 30,000 to under 14,000. And so it's clear we're headed in the wrong direction, and we have to ask why. There's really no compelling evidence that's been provided about the current provisions, about the numbers of employers that are covered currently, having any negative impact. And I agree that what we've heard today, it seems like that it does revolve not around the number of employers covered, but has more to do with the gut and stuff issue around the additional marijuana issue. If this bill is resurfacing again, as it is our understanding, so that the Dash 2 amendment can address the issues related to the mitigating measures and the medical marijuana, we implore you not to use this vehicle to address that issue. With the recent Supreme Court ruling as well, it might become a immediate issue, and even if it doesn't, The basis of this bill doesn't change, and that is that it changes the number of employers not allowed to discriminate. And I would implore you not to use that, this vehicle to do that, is that's really kind of throwing out the baby with the bathwater. One thing I just want to conclude with is that the Silk's fundamental question, as well as mine as a person with a disability, and all the thousands of people we represent, is why would Oregon, who's known in the past to be a real progressive state, recognizing the value and contribution of all its citizens, including those with people with disabilities, want to diminish the current state non-discrimination law? Why in the world would we choose to say yes, add to the people that we can discriminate against, and why would you not want to foster every citizen's ability to enjoy one of the most basic activities we have, which is to be employed, self-reliant, tax-paying members of the community? And so giving these questions and serious concerns and the dramatic impact it could have, especially the basis of this bill around the increase of the number of employers covered, the State Independent Living Council strongly opposes H. Bill 2873, and we thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for summarizing and doing a good job in the time allotted. We have one more witness that is a late signer-upper. Jacqueline Zimmer would like to come forward. And
Chair Catherine White is along as well, and I assume her comments are similar to mine. Members of the committee, for the record, Jacqueline Zimmer with the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. Just letting you know that we're uncomfortable with an issue this complex being brought up this late in a session, being attached to a bill as a gut and stuff, and we think that it merits much more discussion than a few minutes in front of your committee, although we do appreciate the proponent's comments being brief. She wasn't really able to state her entire case, but we would appreciate a much more thorough discussion of this. It would be, I think, unfortunate for legislators to be asked to vote on something as significant as the Americans with Disabilities Act without understanding, even in the amendments, and having it spell out what it really means. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? Okay, seeing none, then I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 287.
Mr. Chair, sorry.
Excuse me. Did I miss you? I'm sorry.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition, which represents 26 organizations that provide services and include families with people with developmental disabilities and individuals with developmental disabilities. Similar to Jacqueline, we have concerns about the purpose of the bill and the wide-ranging implications that this will have on people with disabilities without a great deal more discussion about the bill. Thank you.
Fine. Thank you. And I'm sorry I overlooked you. I'm going too fast again. Okay. Further discussion or further testimony? Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, now I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2873 and open a work session on that bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Why don't we hold off till I talk to some people for a day? We got plenty of time to do it right on Friday if I have to, if we need to move it forward.
All right.
Fine.
Then I'll just conclude the work session and on House Bill 2873, pending further instructions. And further business before the committee. Hearing none, we're adjourned, and I appreciate you getting us to the House session on time.